Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand. The wonderful, the corrupt, and so wonderful at keeping secret the fact that it's corrupt. I'm not kidding. Ladies and gentlemen, this country, New Zealand, is like the Zimbabwe of the South Pacific. Honestly, we have taken lessons and given a ministerial post to Robert Mugabe in Figment. It's crazy. It's just that bad. Have you heard of Transparency International? They're supposed to tell everybody who is the least corrupt country in the world and who's maybe the most corrupt. You know how they figure that out? Well, what they do is they send out a form to the governments of all of these countries and ask them to fill in any corruption that has been happening in their country recently. New Zealand signs it, doesn't fill anything out, and sends it back blank. And hey presto, we're least corrupt in the top three countries in the world. The other two being Singapore, which is run by one man and his family, and Norway, which allows 500 immigrants a year out of a country of 14 million, where New Zealand allows 50,000 a year, and we have 4 million. My very special guest today is Colin Ross. That was off topic. Is Colin Ross. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, you're the man behind the Ross Institute, Ross, I-N-S-T, Ross Inst, like an instant, but without the ant, right?
Right.
.com. RossInst.com is the website. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Sure. Well, I'm a psychiatrist. I was born in Canada, grew up in Canada. I lived for briefly in Sicily, and then about 4 years in England, then back to Canada, went to medical school in Canada, 1977 to 81. Then I was in my psychiatry training, also in Canada, 81 to 85. Worked as a kind of medical school psychiatrist, 85 to 91. And then in 91, moved to Dallas, where I've been ever since. And I've got trauma programs at hospitals in Los Angeles, Dallas and Michigan that I consult to, and I'm involved in the programming and treatment and so on. And those are basically programs for adults with really horrible childhoods, all kinds of abuse and neglect and all kinds of mental health problems as a fallout.
Well, interesting you should say that, because that's kind of what I do for a living. You know, I get all these activists and everything like that, whistleblowers and what have you, that have had their lives destroyed over and over again by these ruthless criminal scumbags that they're trying to expose, but despite their best efforts, all they wind up doing is having their life effed up by these people. I kind of offer a platform to them to really bare their souls and be really comfortable and open and not fear being attacked or judged.
So it's a kind of societal level trauma you deal with?
Yeah. But the problem being, whenever you listen to somebody's trauma, part of it latches onto you.
Right.
Hmm.
There's a guy wrote a very interesting book chapter that I read some years ago. I've met him several times, a guy with a lot of varied interests. And he was in Brazil. He's done a lot of sort of cross-cultural studies. And this group he's describing in Brazil, it's a group of therapist healers. They've got the same treatment protocol for schizophrenia, multiple personality disorder, epilepsy, and demon possession. They treat all those the same way. And basically, everybody lies down in a circle. It's like therapist, client, therapist, client, therapist, client, with their heads at the center and their feet, you know, sticking out like spokes. And then the therapists kind of set things up, and they transfer the negative energy from the patient into the therapist, and the therapist then discharges it into the world. But sometimes the energy gets stuck in the therapist, and they have a bit of a problem.
Yeah, I'd say that's probably about the same with me. I'm still learning how to kind of like take that energy and then bang it out somewhere, you know, right. almost like spew it out like ectoplasm in a figurative way.
Right.
But yeah, sometimes it does kind of compound on you, just kind of emotional trauma, stress, etc. It seems to be something I'm very specialist at sensing and having good instincts about with people. I can sometimes tell what people's problems is or past life traumas or what's happened to them, or at least be specifically suspicious after a few minutes of conversation. Mm. In so doing, and that only happens occasionally, you know, when I'm like pinging really well, it allows me to kind of ask them the right questions sometimes.
Well, that's a good skill for an interviewer.
Yeah. Well, I don't think I'm an interviewer. I think I'm more like a therapist to the stars, you know.
You sure you're getting a lot of stars?
Well, in the conspiracy world, you know, in a cult sensation, fame sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. Because at the end of the day, what I want to do is help to take the culture that we currently have, you know, this celebrity, wow, look at him, culture, and transmute that into actually caring about people who are famous for a very good reason.
Right.
You know, like Nikola Tesla, for example.
Yeah, I know. I wouldn't say I'm a Tesla expert, but I've read a book or two about him and kind of got the general idea. Very amazing, like incredible genius guy, obviously.
Yeah. So if somebody's an incredible genius and they've got really amazing stuff to say and they have done really amazing things, don't you think they should have fame and fortune far more deserving than, say, the likes of Paris Hilton or Honey Boo Boo?
Oh, it all depends on what dress they have, I think.
It does. But then again, the worst dressed can get just as much coverage as the best dressed.
Well, that's true. That's the way it is on Yahoo News now, though. It'll be like people killed in the Ukraine, Paris Hilton's new dress, so-and-so broke up with her boyfriend.
I recall there was some kind of large terrorism accident attack or something of that nature, you know, when they foiled that alleged bombing attack that was going to happen. They were going to blow up multiple airliners across the Atlantic a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on Fox News, and you know how they have those little runners down the bottom of the screen?
Right.
So during them talking about this very serious incident and this attack that's been foiled and how great it is that our security systems that we irradiate everybody is are working, and then it comes down the runner on the bottom of the screen. What's her name from the Destiny's Child? Beyonce. Yeah. Beyonce Knowles says she no longer likes the term bootylicious. Now, who puts these things together? Now,
somebody who's got the demographic down and wants to appeal to both, I guess.
Yeah. It's like, well, you know, people don't really like terrorism, but they do like Beyonce.
So let's just put something along a little bit Beyonce in there with the terrorism. That'll be really good for the demographic.
That's about it, I guess.
That's exactly what happened.
Yeah, the trivialization of the news is just ridiculous.
Can't get enough of it. They really can't. Now, Colin, speaking of, are you a psychiatrist or a psychologist? And more to the point, what's the difference?
Psychiatrists are smarter and more athletic and better looking. Those are the main differences.
Oh, that's what we all know. But yeah. There's an old saying in Hollywood, there's two things the film's about, what the film's about, what the film's really about.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so the actual difference is, so a psychiatrist goes to medical school, gets an MD, and then could become a family doctor, an internist, becomes a psychiatrist, and then has the right to prescribe medications, admit people to hospital. Whereas a psychologist does a BA in psychology, then does a master's in psychology, and then could go into a clinical practice there or could go on to do a PhD. And they can do, they're more research oriented. They also have a therapy stream and they have a psychological testing stream.
And do these two fields marry much at all?
Well, they marry a little bit, but each has always got a machete behind the back. They're always fighting turf wars too.
Is there also like accusations from either side that the other side is quackery or something like that? You know, this kind of like brooding professional feud.
The quackery is not the mainstream to mainstream. They don't do the quackery accusations so much. The big threat to psychiatry is the psychologist getting prescribing rights.
It'll make you obsolete.
Yeah. Well, it'll make the psychiatrists who are totally invested in the only thing I do is prescribe drugs obsolete. Yeah. Wouldn't make me obsolete.
Oh, okay. Well, in that case, I have two questions for you. Number one, experimental drugs and things of that nature. This is a little bit of a story question, I think. Friend of mine was in an institution. He drove the wrong way down a highway off-ramp or something like that, so they put him in the institution for a couple of days. And they gave him this long list of drugs, which each had a long list of side effects, none of which the doctor was able to explain to me what those drugs actually were. That the kind of psychiatrist you're talking about that only prescribes drugs and doesn't really care.
Yeah, I could go on about psychiatric drugs for a long time, but the basic summary of my viewpoint is if you actually look in the psychiatry literature, what's actually published in the literature over and 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 over for all types of antipsychotics, antidepressants, all psych meds, clearly demonstrates that at the most, they're only a little more effective than placebo and they have tons of side effects. So there's several sad things about the state of psychiatry. One is they're totally overinvested in genes, brain chemicals, drugs. The evidence for genes contributing clearly shows that genes are only minor contributor. The drugs don't really work very well, and they have horrible side effects. So the profession's kind of painting itself into this death corner, as far as I'm concerned.
Ironically, though, it's making them richer than any other profession.
Not any other medical profession. Surgeons still earn lots more than psychiatrists.
I'm talking about the pharmaceutical companies who make the drugs. They're the most profitable business in America.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've got various long talks, really long talks, short talks I can do on drugs and slides that go along with that. And I just have a little sampling of the combined criminal and civil settlements by drug companies in the last few years. So there's lots and lots of settlements, like with individual states in the 10, 20 million range. But there's now a set of studies in the settlements in the $500 million range. Then we started getting into, you know, a handful above a billion, and we've got a couple in the 2 billion plus. So it's just, as far as I can tell, it's just cost of doing business. And they go, well, we were down a little in the third quarter because we had to pay the government $2 billion. That's the kind of the scale of money we're talking about.
This reminds me of the scene in Fight Club where he says, my job was to apply the formula. How many vehicles would break down? A. How many people might get killed or damage cause in the average out-of-court settlement? B. And A times B equals X. If X is less than the cost of recalling that car, we don't recall them. So it's the same for the drugs as well. If it's if it's cheap enough to pay pay people off and keep it under wraps while people die in the meantime without having to recall the drug completely, they'll do it. It's a business decision. It's not a moral decision. It's not an ethical decision. They wouldn't be in the pharmaceutical industry exclusively if they had morals or ethics in the first freaking place, would they?
Well, they could be in the industry, but they'd be behaving very differently from how they are now.
Yeah. Well, like they're probably in the industry, but not making all the decisions at the very, very top.
Right. There was just on CBS television on Sunday morning, I was watching a little segment about obesity in America and diabetes in America. So this is mainstream, you know, not disputed facts. The obesity rate in children has doubled in the last couple of decades. And if the growth curve continues at its present rate, by 2030, a third of people in America will have diabetes. And by the end of the century, if the growth curve continues, 90% of Americans will be overweight or obese. So that's a little bit of a public health problem. But psychiatry's got a whole set of medications, these called atypical antipsychotics. Not all of them, but many of them cause weight gain, increased blood sugar, increased lipids, which is metabolic syndrome, which is part of this whole health epidemic of cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure, you know, high fats, high everything.
And then let me guess, once they gain all that weight, they're going to sell them a pill as well to take every day that helps them lose weight. And when their heart starts to have problems or low blood pressure or something like that, then they sell you another pill that's going to take all that blood pressure. And then that'll throw your kidneys out. So you're going to have another pill to actually help correct your kidney function. And then that'll throw your liver out. So you're going to have another pill. You know, and it just keeps going and coming. Before you know it, you're on 52 medications a day.
Yeah, exactly. In an article that was in the, I'm pretty sure it was American Journal of Psychiatry. It was a leading psychiatry journal. They're doing a study just looking at exactly what you're talking about. And it was in kids aged 12 to 17. So all the kids, and this is published around about 4 years ago or so. I've got the exact reference in my slides. So it's all kids 12 to 17. They've all already been on antipsychotics for at least 6 months before the study starts. And then what they do is in the study period, they add on either placebo or metformin, which is a diabetes pill that you take by mouth. And then what they see is that the kids have already gained, let me see if I got the numbers right here. They've already gained an average of 10 kilos up to the start point of the study, just in the 6 months they were on the drugs. During the study, the ones on placebo gain another 15 kilos for a total of 15 in less than a year, whereas the kids who are on the placebo don't gain weight and their blood sugar doesn't go up. And this is about 50 or 60 kids. I forget the exact size of the study. But two of the kids had to be dropped out of the study because they developed full diabetes caused by the medication. So the authors just report this as not from the perspective you just said, but from the perspective of, oh, this is good. Now we're finding out a way to manage the side effects of our drugs so we can keep prescribing them. When the drugs are literally causing diabetes in kids.
Now, what kind of a monster deliberately makes children sick to line their own pockets?
Well, from the psychiatrist, to me, there's a few psychiatrists that talk are probably just pure scheming psychopath people. But most psychiatrists are just bought into the program, so to speak. And they kind of go, oh, well, our top priority is treating these symptoms. And, you know, we just have to live with the side effects.
Well, I find this very interesting because all of you have to go to college or university or something like that, and all of you have to be taught a recognition of logical fallacies and the trivium, etc., during a philosophy class and what have you. Yet, it's the only thing that is used to argue in favor of these overarching terrible health epidemics, you know. Mm. It's the only thing that allows it to continue. Why is it being taught but not followed?
Well, funnily enough, it's not actually taught in the sense that people go in Canada was even more so because you could get into medical school with only 2 years of undergraduate study, so which I did. So I read like tons and tons and tons outside all that. But if you got 2 years of university, so that means you basically got five courses per year, full courses or a combination of full and halves. For 2 years. So that's 10 full courses that you could take in 2 years. You got to take biology for a year, physics for a year, organic chemistry for a year, and inorganic chemistry for a year. So you've only got six courses left. Oh, you've got to take math for a year. So that's five. So you're now down to five full year courses left over that are, from the point of view of medical school, electives. So you get into medical school very easily without ever learning how to think critically, how to reason, basic principles of philosophy, of argument. And then once you're in medical school, everybody thinks there's all this scientific training. But actually, in fact, medical school is much more like a trade school. It's learning a bunch of facts, techniques. You don't actually learn in medical school how to conduct a scientific experiment, how to analyze evidence, how to think critically about the literature. And then you go into psychiatry, and again, you have a journal club where you kind of discuss some papers, but the ability of the average psychiatrist to really scientifically scrutinize a research paper is pretty limited.
By chance, do they use standard mind control techniques, herd mentalities, forcing or silo mentality / sleep deprivation, massive workload?
Yes, to all the above. So, I went through medical school. I remember, I guess it was second or third year medical school, but somewhere in medical school, we had a surgeon. No, it was first year medical school because, we were doing gross anatomy and there was a surgery resident who was kind of like a teaching assistant in the gross anatomy. And he would come around and give us pointers and help out. And he was just a nice guy. So I was talking to him. And he was a general surgeon. He was talking about a neurosurgery resident. And neurosurgeons are the highest paid and the hardest working and the longest hours in medicine. And, like, are incredibly skilled people. But this neurosurgery resident was completely bummed out and overwhelmed and devastated because they clamped down on him and made him only be on call every second night instead of every night. And he was all devastated because he was going to miss all these good cases. And so in surgery in general, but even more so in neurosurgery, if you're on call and somebody comes in with a serious head injury from a car accident, you can go in the OR at 10 p.m. and not come out till 6 a.m. night after night after night after night. So that's the extreme. But I experienced not dozens and dozens and dozens of nights, but some nights where I got under 2 hours sleep. And you're not firing on all cylinders after that, I can tell you for sure. So there's definitely sleep deprivation. There's kind of life deprivation because there's so much work and study to do. There's a lot of...
That's another technique of mind control is isolation as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you'd go into... especially in the internship period, you'd go arrive at the hospital. Depending on surgery, you might have to arrive at 7 a.m. Everybody else probably would arrive at 8 a.m. You'd work all day, go, 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 go. And then normally you'd go home at 7. But if you're on call, you stay, you keep working, you sleep sometimes 4 or 5 hours, sometimes an hour or two. Then you're back at work at 8 a.m., and then you go home at 7 p.m. So from you know, you left home at 7 p.m. yesterday, and you arrive home at 7:30 p.m. today, and that whole time, you've never been in natural sunlight. You've been in an enclosed space, busy, busy, go, 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 artificial light, horrible food, stress, busy. So it's very much a sensory deprivation environment, no question. Then there's the whole kind of groupthink, social conformity, all kinds of...
Any collective punishment?
The collective punishment comes in several forms. Like nobody, very rarely does anybody actually get kicked out of medical school. But if you don't have the right attitude, you just get all this. It's just like being in a, you know, a tribe of 40 people. It's just this little cohesive social unit. And if you get ostracized, like socially, emotionally, by looks, by tone of voice, you're in serious trouble. So it's all kind of interpersonal, social control, tone of voice, facial expressions, what people say, not getting the big handshake, not getting the promotion. That's how everybody's kind of controlled and kept in line. And then there's just sort of modeling. So the doctors behave the way they do, and you pretty soon learn that you better copy them or you're going to be an outlier.
It seems very similar to the way vicious animal trainers would strike a dog if it does something you don't want.
Yeah, except instead of a stick, it's a look.
And they can strike just as hard and cut even worse.
Yeah, they can, yeah. Yes, and you see, like, the first day of medical school, I was a little older than the average student because I was had an illustrious career as a high school dropout for 6 or 7 years. And so I was 27 when I started medical school. And I lived up in the Canadian Arctic and, you know, had all kinds of adventures and so on. But the average, probably 90% of the class, were urban, Caucasian, middle or upper middle class kids who had lived at home with their parents, studied hard, got good grades in high school, went to college for 2 or 3 years, studied, got top grades, got into medical school. And that's their life experience. They walk in on day one. So here's me. I've lived in Sicily, England, the Canadian Arctic. I have 2 kids. I've already published a book or two, writing poetry, reading anthropology, and so on. So their life experience was so narrow. But they were quite an idealistic, you know, young, energetic group of people who wanted to do the best for their patients, wanted to save lives, wanted to learn everything so they wouldn't miss something which would then harm a patient. And then gradually they just get socialized, ground down and socialized into being kind of these, all their feelings are buried somewhere inside, grandiose, narcissistic bosses of the medical field. It's a whole socialization process that was very dramatic and very clear.
But how did they take away a feeling of consequence for actions? Like if patients have bad side effects or something, oh, it's not your fault. They just had a bad reaction and it's their genetics or something?
Yes and no. So if you're an intern or a resident and you actually foul up and something goes wrong, then you can get really chewed out by the attending physician, the boss physician. But as long as you didn't do something like really obviously stupid, yeah, it's all just, well, that's the way it goes, or that's the patient, or these things happen. Yeah, there's a huge minimization of side effects and an overestimation of how effective the medications are, especially in psychiatry, but also quite a bit in other areas of medicine.
Well, and also perhaps a lack of belief or discernment in wanting to use other, perhaps more viable options than the drugs that don't work and actually do worse and harm, which is kind of a violation of the Hippocratic Oath, isn't it? First, do no harm.
Oh, yeah. The Hippocratic Oath is getting stomped in the ground all the time.
I was thinking we need to rename it, you know, for the modern time. I mean, it's like Greeks, you know, that was ages ago. Let's have a Hippocratic Oath, okay?
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that, yeah.
I swear that we won't do any harm, but if we do harm, it's your fault, not ours. Yeah.
Well, the official statistic of the U.S. government is about 225,000 deaths per year in the United States in hospitals caused by medication errors and medication side effects.
Actually, that was updated. It's a...
Well, has it grown now?
It's now one person... No. Seven people a minute or seven people an hour, something along those. It's ridiculous. The leading cause of death in America is the medical system that's trying to save them from dying.
Well, in the United States also... The United States is just a country of extremes all the time. So it's got really wonderful positive extremes, and it's got really horrible negative extremes. But it spends more of its gross national product on health care than any other country in the world by a considerable margin. And in a recent survey, the U.S. ranked 79th in the world on health, the actual health of the citizenry.
Yeah.
Top spender, 79th outcome.
Who were your neighbors there? Were they, Nigeria?
Yeah.
Chad?
Like that. Yeah, things like that. Yeah.
You're actually healthier if you live in Ethiopia than if you've got McDonald's around the corner.
Right. And it was not quite as bad for education. Like in education, like standardized exam performance of high school kids, U.S. is like around 35 or something in the world.
I've had a number of people from New Zealand go to the States, and they were like C students here or something like that.
Right.
And they get like A pluses in the States, and they come back going, man, that student gap year was easy, you know? It was so easy. And I think one thing that's happened to Americans over a number of generations of isolationist culture and not a very well-traveled people is that they don't have an awareness of themselves by comparison to other places. And I think that's what travel and speaking to people from different cultures on a regular basis really gives you. It gives you a perspective. What is that in the background there? Some kind of scraping?
Oh, sorry. I was just twirling the cap from my water bottle.
Oh, sorry.
Good microphone, I guess.
Yeah. Allegedly. Now, if Americans were capable of actually seeing themselves as other people see them, would they change their behavior? I think so.
If they believe the perception.
Yeah. But here's the other thing as well. Another thing that comes with isolation and constant reinforcement of your general belief structure is hubris and blind belief in that structure. You know, there are still Americans today, despite all available evidence, who will still think that the Republicans or the Democrats aren't working together.
You know, there's a whole pantomime of them fighting with each other all the time. It's endless.
I mean, it's like Jesse Ventura said, Governor Jesse Ventura. It's just like pro wrestling. In public, I'm going to beat the crap out of you. In private... Would you like another drink?
Yeah. I was on his TV show in one of his episodes. He's a really cool guy. I like him a lot. And very knowledgeable. I mean, he's obviously a showman. Obviously, he's been a wrestler, was a Navy SEAL. But he knows a lot of stuff about a lot of different topics. He's a very well-studied, well-researched guy.
Oh, yeah. In order to be a SEAL, you need to be in the top 10% of humanity. Maybe top 5, maybe top 1.
Yeah, I'd say one.
Yeah, in terms of intelligence and personal constitution, I think that's actually what it really comes down to, because there's certain things your body can do that your mind won't allow you to, and I think that's what they're looking for when they're looking for the best soldiers, those people who can override their body functions using the strength of mind, and that's what makes them so intelligent and so deadly.
Yeah, he said that the Navy SEALs are not really your stereotypical bunch of, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger type guys. There are guys like that, but there's also like a surfer, a musician, you know, a history major. It's a whole, it's quite a diverse collection of different types of people.
It's the same with Special Air Services in New Zealand as well, rumored to be the best in the world.
Right.
My sisters going out with an ex-SAS guy. And I remember one time when I was a boy, a friend of my mother's, Phil, who just lived down the road to us on the beach, three guys came into his house with a bike chain, a baseball bat, and a knife. Three guys came out of his house. One was dead, one with a broken neck, would never walk again, and the other one with two broken legs and a broken arm.
Right. And yeah, I greatly admire those guys. I don't greatly admire U.S. foreign policy, but those individual guys, I greatly admire them.
Yeah. I mean, let's have a look at what people's achievements are out of context, you know. Let's not think about what part they play in the big machine. Let's talk about individuals as individuals, because otherwise we're just playing the same him versus him. Oh, I hate the military, blah, 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 BS. You know, these are just normal people at the end of the day. You take the boots off, you take the helmet off, you take the guns away. They're just like you and me, except they can freaking kill you with their thumb.
One minor difference, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's the little things that matter, you know. Okay, we'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen. Colin Ross from rossinst.com. That's inst, like instant, or like an institute. And also remember, we are sponsored by a few wonderful little people, the High Tea Cafe in New Lynn there in Auckland. Check that out. We've got a couple of books on sale as well. The Crowdfunding Revolution, How to Raise Venture Capital Using Social Media by Kevin Lawton. The Range of Illusion, a Provinces novel by B. Holmes. You can get those on the homepage. Also check out the Gourmet Soap Kitchen banner down there in Wagga Wagga, Australia. I just love saying the word Wagga Wagga. Wagga Wagga. It's good. It's like a frog noise. And also Blue Shield, because as we all know, there's a hell of a lot of extra nasty radiation stuff coming off of pretty much everything, including the computer that you might be listening to this on right now. All right. We'll see you after the break, ladies and gentlemen. Don't you go anywhere.
Trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. My very special guest is still Colin Ross. Now, you've come up with trauma treatment programs, I take it. And you said you mostly dealt with children?
No, it's all adults, but all they've had horrible childhoods.
Oh, okay.
And then I also work with increasingly a pretty consistent number of military people with military trauma.
Any people with... I was always thinking about this in terms of military trauma. I mean, there was a film. What was it? Dog Soldiers. Dog Soldiers. Oh yeah, he tells a story. We were patrolling on the Afghan border or something like that, Iraqi border. Sorry, and Richie, poor bugger, triggered an anti-tank mine. You know, lads, it really puts things into perspective when you have to scoop up your mate with a shovel and pop them in a bin bag. You know, you can't think about actually experiencing what some soldiers have experienced without kind of like this intense shock, like a part of whatever they felt at that moment kind of like seeps onto you if you're empathetic enough. And it's quite freaking horrible, man.
That's for sure. I just saw a really, really powerful, one of the most powerful movies I've ever seen, called Railway Man, where Colin Firth was playing a guy who was in a Japanese prisoner of war camp in the Second World War. And now it's kind of flashbacks to the Second World War, flash forwards to him in 1980, and his wife is Nicole Kidman. And they both, Nicole Kidman does a good job, but she's a minor character. Colin Firth does an astounding job. It's really well written, and there's a kind of reconciliation between him and his prison guard that takes place in 1980 when he goes back basically to kill the prison guard. It's one of the most powerful, well-written, moving trauma of war movies I've ever seen.
I do think this is something that needs to really be talked about quite a bit more, specifically because of the fact that people whom this sort of trauma has happened to don't normally like to talk about it.
Yeah, and that's portrayed very, very vividly in this movie.
Yeah.
We have a gigantic problem in the U.S. of suicide in the military. And it includes both guys who've been deployed and guys who haven't been deployed. In both groups, there's between double and triple the rate of suicide compared to the general population. And so I wrote a paper in a journal recently. It was just published a few months ago, titled Self-Blame and Suicidal Ideation in Combat Veterans. And it's basically based on working therapeutically with a whole series of people with combat trauma. So this is, if you figure there's all the guys in the military, then you narrow down to all the guys who get deployed, then you narrow down to all the guys who see combat, then you narrow down to all the guys who've got post-traumatic stress disorder, then you narrow down to all the guys with post-traumatic stress disorder who are suicidal, and then you narrow down to all the guys with post-traumatic stress disorder who are suicidal who get admitted to a mental hospital. So that's a pretty select group. But nevertheless, I think you can learn a lot of general lessons from the most extreme, most disturbed guys. And time after time after time after time, basically without exception, in my experience, which is dozens and dozens and dozens of people, including a bunch of women, the core theme is self-blame for something that happened over there. Either buddy died, civilian children died, civilians died, something bad happened, and the person is blaming themselves. And then the self-imposed punishment is self-hatred, horrible negative self-talk, just tormenting yourself with flashbacks, nightmares, PTSD, believing you don't have a right to happiness or a decent life, believing that you're a monster, believing your family would be better off without you. And in effect, the person kind of court-martials themselves and puts a death sentence on their own head, which then, if you go all the way down the path, leads to suicide. And so you'd think it's kind of dumb. Here's a civilian guy, grew up in Canada, never been in the military, never seen combat. What's he got to say to somebody who's come back from Afghanistan? But I think the reason that I'm helpful is I've figured out this self-blame theme, which is so core and is driving so many of the symptoms. And almost all the time, if I sit down and I walk through the series, so there'll be one or two like key scenarios that happened that kind of represent the entire picture of being over there. So I'll go through one of those key scenarios, and it'll be something like we were in a convoy. I was at the end of the convoy, and the truck at the front hit a IED, improvised explosive device, blew up, and the guy died. Okay, so how's that your fault? Well, I should have been in the front truck. That's where I usually am. But that day, the guy who was supposed to be in the back truck was sick, so my commander told me to take over the position in the back, and he put somebody else in the front. And so it'd be just things like that. When you go through it step by step, it's clearly not the person's fault. And so I go through a process of, okay, let's go through this step by step. Explain to me how it's your fault. Is that really fair? Would you blame anybody else who's in the same position? And basically try and kind of philosophically debate them out of the self-blame to a position that, you know, war is horrible. People die. Not everybody can be saved. It wasn't predictable. It wasn't controllable. It just happened. And you don't deserve to be punished. And what do you think your dead buddy wants you to be doing now? Tormenting yourself? or having a life so that at least somebody got to have a life. So that's kind of like the core theme that I work on all the time. So there's the horror of the events, but underneath what's really driving it is a lot of self-blame often.
Needless self-blame.
Yeah. Humanly normal, natural self-blame, but needless.
Well, who is to blame then? Yeah, and where's the justice for all these people that are suffering these traumas needlessly?
Yeah, the culture does a pitiful job of helping them when they get back home. I mean, there are programs in the military and there's some help, but it's such a drop in the bucket compared to the need.
Well, there's also the need for combat veterans on the front line, to the point in which Department of Defense librarian Douglas Dietrich has discovered that they purposely put black marks on a lot of combat veterans' military records so that when they come home, they've got a certain serial number that when their employers check it up, says that they're a pedophile or a thief or a psychopath or something crazy like that so that they can't get a job. And so it kind of forces them to go back into rotation. The reason being is because if you've got a fresh, if you've got fresh meat coming in, they don't have combat experience and they're a hell of a lot less useful. They don't know what they're doing.
Right.
Whereas if you can force a combat veteran to come back, even though they don't want to, because they don't have a choice, it's a lot more cost effective, more or less. It's a way to save money and lives.
Well, another movie I saw more like about 5 years ago was a very small independent movie called Stop Loss. It wasn't as intense as Railway Man, but it was a well-done movie. And so Stop Loss is a program where you sign up and the agreement is you sign up for this many years and then you're going to get out and you do one tour and now it's time to leave the military. And they just go, nope, we changed the deal. And they redeploy the guy completely like against the initial contract. In a civil situation, it'd be a breach of contract and it'd be a civil case and the whole thing would be taken care of. So there's multiple mechanisms for keeping people in. I've also talked to many guys who just can't fit in at home. And the only place they get a rush and feel alive is in combat. And they can't wait to go back and kill the bad guys and get the rush.
See, and that's the mind control working there, eh? Turning ordinary, good American kids into killing machines.
Yeah. A lot of people think that mind, especially people who are more skeptical, think that mind control is some kind of like huge, fancy, science
machine
fiction
apparatus. No. Mind control has been used for years in the military.
Exactly.
Just basic things like taking away your ability to think by depriving you of sleep is a mind control technique. It's all very simple.
And shaving everybody's head.
Yeah, it relieves you of your identity and your individuality. People can't even tell what color your hair is, let alone what style you put it in to reflect you. Yeah. Do you have long hair or do you keep it cut nice? And you know, do you style it? It doesn't matter. None of that. You're all the same now. If you remove your individuality, it opens the door for collective programming, collective punishment, and things of that nature, you know? You get down and give me 20. No, okay, then everybody has to get down and give me 20 now. All right? So that way everybody starts to obey the master, the sergeant and what have you, because it's to save your life, etc., and to train you properly from being a maggot into a lean, mean fighting machine, blah, blah, blah. Give you all these wonderful promises. It's quite psychopathic in a way, actually. It's exactly the way psychopaths deal with people. They tell you you're the best there is and blah, 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 and then they treat you like crap until they've got what they want from you, and then they just suddenly then reveal, yes, actually, I really don't care about you at all. You're going back over there, son. I don't care if it's on contract.
Yeah, I work with a combination of people who are still very patriotic and loyal to the military and people who feel extremely betrayed by the military. I'm talking about combat veterans. So I've seen kind of like both attitudes a lot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, see, this is one thing that I actually understand quite a lot, having talked to a number of veterans, etc. But getting them to really talk about their experiences is something that it's like pulling hen's teeth. It's really difficult to get them to open up and just kind of admit that it's not their fault. and to admit that they were fooled and they were lied to or whatever.
Right. But everything's a sign of weakness is the problem.
Yeah, well...
That's how the culture defines it all.
Yeah.
You know, men don't cry multiplied by 1,000. Actually, when every single guy is, you know, bawling his head off inside all the way through.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you got to let it out, mate. And this is the problem, I think, is we're incapable of letting things out. So we bottle them up and then they fester like a... it's like an infection, more or less, that just suddenly sits in there like a cancer, actually. Better analogy. Because it just grows and grows and grows. And it sucks the blood out of your body so that it can continue to grow. And then you get weaker as it grows stronger until eventually it overtakes you and you die.
Yeah, there's jumping out of military combat to child sexual abuse. There's a motto that a guy who writes in the literature came up with. Incest is the gift that keeps on giving. It's just what you're saying. It takes over, it grows, and it just permeates every facet of your life.
I spoke to another man about helping people with that kind of sexual trauma. And his methodology was like almost 2 weeks, Colin, of sitting there talking to these women and men on a one-on-one basis and sharing comparable stories of trauma that's happened in his life as well to help to relay to them, help to them put it in context and that kind of thing. So it's like something that happened to you one instance can affect you your entire life until one person decides to devote a couple of weeks of their personal time to help you get over it now and forever. I think that's the power of people like you, Colin, is that you're able to relieve people of lifelong afflictions that they've inflicted upon themselves.
Right, and they've inflicted them, but not just in no context. They've inflicted these inflictions on themselves because that's a normal human response to trauma. And they just didn't do it out of the blue for no reason. So like kids, for instance, and often the people in combat who are now back home, who are the most suicidal, most blaming themselves, when you go back to their childhood, they were already in the pattern of blaming themselves as kids for family violence, physical abuse of mom, physical and sexual abuse, you know, emotionally absent parents, emotional neglect. So this, I'm a bad kid, and that's why my parents are abusing and neglecting me, gets ingrained very early. And then you just add a whole layer of military on trauma on top. And the reason that kids blame themselves is simply because that's how kids' brains work. Kids always think they're at the center of the world and everything revolves around them and they cause everything that happens. So if you're in like the mythical, healthy, normal family, you learn that the world's a fair place, that people are trustworthy, that you're lovable. So you grow up safe, secure, good self-esteem. Life just rolls out. But when you grow up in a huge trauma family, you learn that you're unworthy, you're bad, you don't deserve love. Your only role in the world is to be somebody's punching bag or sex object. And that gets ingrained over and over and over and over, year after year after year. Then you go into the military and then you're in a firefight and some civilian kids get killed. That, you know, dark monster of self-blame just takes over the whole picture.
Yeah, I think I've actually got quite a bit of that myself, you know. Dad was pretty violent, and then he was gone after 10 years or so of being in my life. And, it's actually been quite a self-blaming life that I've had. You know, why did I do that? Why did I do this? Why did that happen to me? And
working your way out of it is a big project.
Well, what I've found is it's much easier to work yourself out of a hole that you've dug if you've got somebody else to help dig your way out.
No kidding.
And so what I've done more or less is I've tried to, well, this is my job now, more or less.
Right.
Is helping to relay back and forth with other people who may or may not have had similar traumas or things of that nature. And I feel that if I can help them in some way, that in some way it helps me and helps to alleviate my guilt. And at some point I'll be able to say, you know what, I'm no longer guilty at all. You know, I don't feel it. It's not bad. In fact, funnily enough, speaking of mention about the self-guilt and self-hate and punishment, I spent about nearly 2 months not really publishing any shows. I recorded a whole bunch. But more or less nearly two months of doing very, very little work and just kind of like sitting at home feeling sorry for myself, not wanting to edit any shows or record anything more. It just really felt bad. Really, and as I was feeling bad, I started to feel guilty because I'm not doing my shows and donations are still rolling in from people who expect to listen to new shows. So I felt really guilty about that. And then one listener tells me, Vinny, you've spent years and years doing the radio show. You've provided, you know, all this entertainment, all this knowledge and all this counseling to people who've gone through some real crap. I think you deserve it. Stop feeling guilty. And not only did I stop feeling guilty at that moment, I also felt like getting back to work.
Cool. Yeah, people tell me that all the time. Like, I'll work with them and then I'll see them 4 years later and they'll say, you know, the one thing that really made a difference, and there'll be some statement I made that I just thought was kind of like an off-the-cuff thing. So it's you can't always tell who's going to make what statement that's really going to strike home.
Well, that's because it's in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? What we interpret a statement to be is more or less what the statement becomes, regardless of how it's intended.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
intention helps it along and pointing in the right direction sometimes. But yeah.
What I use a metaphor, not all the time, but fairly often, of it's sort of like the court martial, but it's in the civilian context of, okay, so what was your crime? My crime was, and it doesn't have to be a legal crime, but a moral, emotional, spiritual crime. My crime was I seduced my father when I was 8 years old and caused him to sexually abuse me. So, of course, we're going to work on it wasn't under your control. It's totally 100% responsibility on him. But before we get to that, I might go, okay, so what's your sentence then? You committed a crime. What's your sentence? And the sentence is being unhappy, being miserable, having flashbacks, hating yourself, having lousy relationships forever. And then I'll go, okay. And what's the length of the sentence? And they'll go, well, life. They're really life. Huh. Well, so some people rob banks and shoot people. The people don't die and they get like 10 years in jail. To get life in jail, you pretty well have to murder somebody. So who did you murder? I didn't murder anybody. Okay, so maybe the sentence is a little out of proportion to the usual sentencing guidelines. And so you're the judge, the jury, the warden, and the parole board all rolled into one.
And eventually executioner.
Right. So let's have a parole board hearing. What does this person really deserve for a sentence? When are they going to get out? And and then it's not just as simple as that, but that's kind of one of the approaches that I use to get the person to reconsider and say, well, maybe I've served my sentence plus an extra 10 years I didn't really need to serve. And maybe it's time to forgive myself for the crime that I never actually committed. And one of the reasons people stall out on that a lot is if you're bad, and you cause the abuse, first of all, you're going to just think that way because kids always think that way automatically. But that means that you've got it contained inside you. This is going on because of the badness that's inside me. So if I figure this out and I decide to be a good little boy or a good little girl, then my parents won't need to do this tough love program anymore because they'll realize I'm a good kid. So it creates this illusion that you've got power and control over the situation. And it's just like the battered spouse who's at the battered spouse shelter. And she's been there. This is her eighth visit to the battered spouse shelter. She keeps going back to the guy. And one more time, she starts going, oh, poor guy's stressed out. Economy's kind of tough. If I just go back and work on being a better wife, he won't be so stressed out and he won't have to beat me up anymore. So it's the illusion that the badness that's causing the trauma is inside you. And if you can just reform yourself and be better, people will stop hurting you. So that thought pattern gets ingrained and is running the show 20, 30, 40 years later. The problem is when you reverse that and you go, wait a minute here, I was just a kid. No kid deserves to be abused. that would appear to be good news because you let go of the self-blame. But then you're face-to-face with the reality of the situation, which is you are really scared, sad, small, lonely, trapped. So it's that powerless, helpless grief underneath that's really hard to deal with. But if you stay all wrapped up in the negativity and the self-blame, you have this illusion of power and control, and you're out of the grief.
It does happen for me a bit as well. I take insults real personal. And it's kind of like extreme defensiveness. And I think it's because I don't feel like I deserve it and feel like some need to kind of like justify my actions and justify myself. And I think I have, you know, I do enough good in this world to justify my existence, I think. I don't think anybody could look at what I do or what I have done for people and say, you know, he's unworthy of life in terms of doing the right thing, I believe. But yet still feel guilty, still feel obligated, and still feel sad and depressed and feel the need to defend myself. It's really, really messed up. It's getting better by the day.
That's good.
But it's still there, and it's a process. You know, like they say in Analyze This, it's grief. It's a process.
Right.
Okay.
That was very funny movie, Analyze This.
It was. And also another movie you've got to see, Colin, considering our discussion of veterans, is The Boys of Abu Ghraib. That was a very, very good film, I must say.
Yeah, that is a good film.
I do. And ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't seen it, for goodness sake, get off your ass. We are coming to break now. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen. We are funded by you, the listeners, mostly. Okay, we've got a few ads and banners and things like that on the website, but at the end of the day, the lion's share of the funding for this broadcast comes from you, the listeners, who just give us stuff just because you can. And incidentally, that's exactly the same way all the sponsors work as well. You know, they're not really making a whole lot of money off of this. They're just giving me a little bit so I can continue doing what I'm doing. And I hope that you do too. You can give as little as $1 a month or any amount you want, you know. The more the better, obviously, because it would be really nice if we could expand this operation, have employees, a proper office, or, you know, wouldn't it be really good, you know, far off future kind of thought process that I got a home, you know, like an actual home that I can, like, tear walls down and put in soundproofing and all of that stuff and just be able to have, like, a spare bedroom for people to come in and, you know, train them and to do all this stuff that I can do rent free. You know, it'd be good to have that kind of resources from the community in order to be able to do that, so I can turn everybody into a person with my kind of skill set, so they can go out and they can help so many other different people who've got so many important things to say as well. We'll be right back.